Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 56, right at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 637. Okay, so here we are, the final paper, part two of the Urantia book. Remember, this is the second of a pair of papers that are about universal coordination. I tried to bring that out as we went through the Light and Life, that that's the the real key of what differentiates light, the various stages of Light and Life and the precursor to it, is that definitively bringing in various influences that encourage the people and the domains to be in ever higher states of coordination, ever higher states of relationship to the whole. You can see this paper must be very much immediately in that mode just by the title of the paper. You'll see in the very first line of this paper that they're bringing out what I was saying about the universal coordination. The paper itself is entitled Universal Unity. Let me just point out up front that something that I've said many times, but needs to be re-emphasized here. The word unity has to do multiple duty in the Revelation. Sometimes it's used in a very, very specific mode in the context of the threefold actuality of individuality, associativity, and unity, quote unquote. But it also serves duties on a vast hierarchy, as sort of just a quick and dirty reference to some level of a phenomenon being together as one. And when you start saying things like together as one, that additionally brings in that issue of contrast between using the word unity relative to the word oneness, and you can get into lots of subtleties. It's always very important to be on your toes when you're interpreting the passages in the Revelation that talk about unity. Because even in the span of one paragraph, it could be taking on multiple usages. So, you would think that making the title of this final paper Universal Unity like this, that the first and foremost desire of the authors is to just invoke the most sweeping, the most transcendent, everything all together that you can imagine, and its universality. But we want to talk a lot about how that comes to be in an evolutionary domain, when you don't just have some sort of existential existence, some fiat existence of quote-unquote unity, but you are trying to achieve that through some complex process. And that word coordination obviously relates to how that could come to be, that something would eventually be considered a unity at some level. All right. I think that's probably enough preface. We'll have lots and lots of things to say here. As we wade into this, people are familiar with this paper. Know there's an awful lot here, and they're often in a very, very synopsis mode. So we kind of need to take some time and slowly step our way through things to get a better appreciation of what's there besides occasional passages of compelling poetic prose. All right, so let's see what they, how do they start us out here?
Paper 56, Universal Unity. God is unity. Deity is universally coordinated. The universe of universes is one vast integrated mechanism which is absolutely controlled by one infinite mind. The physical, intellectual, and spiritual domains of universal creation are divinely correlated. The perfect and imperfect are truly interrelated, and therefore may the finite evolutionary creature ascend to paradise in obedience to the universal Father's mandate, be you perfect, even as I am perfect.
Okay. Now, one thing that we will we'll see them doing throughout, as always, when they are trying to get us to recognize those aspects of the revelation that they're not allowed to give us in any part, but when they are trying to encourage us to synthesize in, with the revelation and really begin to recognize the nature of the whole and the individuality of the whole, that is, the Paradise Trinity and the Mother, they have to encourage that recognition via a discussion that utilizes the seven absolutes of infinity. Right? So they're suggesting using the seven absolutes in various analogy modes. Right, it's not that they're not saying something important immediately about some of the absolutes, but they're doing more than that. Right? The statements about the absolutes and the revelation are often not an end in itself, but also a means to a greater end of recognition. And that is definitely the case here. The very fact that you saw the word coordinated in there, I emphasize this all the time. That word is always bringing forth either the Mother or the Paradise Trinity or both. Just a little aside before we get into the details of the paragraph. Let me just remind you of a couple of statements about the Paradise Trinity that are made almost at kind of the two ends of the entire book. I often refer to this passage. It's way back in the foreword, and if you wanted to turn to it, it's on page 15. That section 12 in the foreword on the Trinities. The second paragraph there in section 12 of the foreword starts out with the Paradise Trinity in italics there, so you'll be able to pick that up easily with your eye. Let me just read into that a little bit and remind you of what's between the lines of those statements, because it's relevant to what we're talking about here. So it starts out, it says, the Paradise Trinity, and then parenthetically it says, the eternal deity union of the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. So that's that bottom-up point of view where you're thinking of the Paradise Trinity as a supersummative consequence of, again, see, using three of the elements of the seven absolutes, like I just said, using that to leverage off of to try to get you to where they want to take you. But see, you can just skip over that. Just say, okay, skip over that parenthetical. The Paradise Trinity is existential in actuality. So speaking of just the Paradise Trinity directly, as an existential fact, it's this actuality. It's the whole, you know, that I was just referring to. At that, basically at that highest level, certainly the highest when you're just in kind of an introductory mode, I mean, it's the wholeness that you can think of the seven absolutes existing within. Earlier in the foreword, when they talk about the seven absolutes of infinity, you know, they say total infinite reality is existential in seven phases and has seven coordinate absolutes. What coordinates them? All right, the Paradise Trinity. That word coordinate is tied to the Paradise Trinity. And when you're just thinking in that existential mode, right, that coordination is, you know, it's not the mother, it's the Paradise Trinity. But notice it doesn't just say that, you know, that the Paradise Trinity is existential in actuality. It says also, comma, but all potentials are experiential. What are they referring to there? You know, they seem to be saying you can think on the one hand of the Paradise Trinity as an actuality, and on the other hand, it's in some way like a potentiality. Mother Deity stems from the Paradise Trinity. And Mother Deity is the overarching facet of deity of all experiential deity. And that contrast between existential and experiential, and the Paradise Trinity being an actuality, you know, relative to the existential, and a potentiality relative to the experiential. You know, you can think of Mother Deity as originating from the Paradise Trinity. And that's what they're referring to there. So you have the whole, and then you have the individuality of the whole that stems downward in a hierarchy through all of the experiential, the Mother Deity. And it also says, you know, this is what I so often refer to, therefore, does this Trinity constitute the only deity reality embracing infinity? And we'll skip the rest of it. We don't need to go into all the details. But that issue that as a facet of deity, the Paradise Trinity is the only fact, the only facet of deity that directly engages the threefold actuality as a triunity in totality, you know, embracing infinity, the totality of reality, right, in its triunity mode. Okay, so there's that passage, and then way almost at the very end of paper 196, in section 3 of paper 196, it's on page 2094 in the single column. As you scan into, you know, it's a fairly long section, that last section. As you scan in there a ways, you know, you start to see some numbered lists. See the second enumerated list there, where they're talking about moral choice, ethical choice, religious choice, and then a tiny little single sentence paragraph after that. And then the next bigger paragraph after that. It's on the very bottom of the page of 2094 in the single column. I just wanted you to put, you know, you may remember that, you know, they seem to be referring to, you know, the thought adjuster in a very complicated way. You know, unless a divine lover lived in man, remember that passage? You know, those are familiar with the book. Well, at the end of that paragraph, notice that there's, and it's capitalized, the title of our paper here, right? Universal Unity. You know, it says, this interpreter is a part of universal unity. This evaluator is the child of the center and source of all absolute values of divine and eternal reality. So at the same time that they're invoking this phrase, universal unity, they're using the expression center and source instead of source and center. Some sort of a reciprocal to the normal father-like mode that we're always thinking of source and center. center in SARS. They're again referring to when you see that flipped around like that, you know, again, they're invoking either the Paradise Trinity or the Mother or both. They're invoking the other half of the picture. Not the source and center half, but the center and source half. See, so, and then just, you know, without going into any details there, you can just see that they're pointing out that inherently, if you're going to talk about universal unity, you're going to be bringing in the Paradise Trinity and the Mother. You're going to see the word coordinate and coordination, you know, and coordinate. Okay, so, you know, back to paper 56. Just wanted to give you a little sense that it's in the wholeness of the revelation, you can recognize what they're doing, you know, sort of more deeply than what immediately meets the eye in these sentences that we're going to be reading in this paper. When it starts out, it seems to start out in a mode that you can get your hands on with the word God. But it doesn't say kind of the old-fashioned thing of God is spirit. It says God is unity. And you know, in that very first section in the foreword, fundamental quality of deity is unity. It's like, well, why are you bringing that in? Well, what's the next word? What's the beginning of the next sentence? Right? You go, when you see God is unity, deity is universally coordinated, is that not a little hint? You know, that, oh yeah, that's right. The definition of that symbol, G-O-D, that word symbol, G-O-D, God is personalized deity. They're expecting you to immediately be thinking that so that it doesn't seem like a non sequitur when the next sentence immediately addresses deity. Right? And of course God is unity because God is personalized deity and the fundamental quality of deity is unity. Right? Oh, and you see, oh, we are right from the very first sentence. They're wanting you to get into a deeper mode or a more transcendent mode, you might say. You know, and you think about various personalizations of deity, like God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit. But what do they say next? It's like, okay, yeah, if you're thinking about that deity and its various personalizations as God, okay, but all that deity is universally coordinated. There's something transcendent. Right? And as I pointed out, you can see in the foreword, most immediately when you're thinking about like the three existential persons, right, it's the Paradise Trinity that is coordinating that personalized deity universally. And there it is, universally coordinated, like I said. You know, the title of this block of two papers is Universal Coordination. Just invoking that recognition there in that sentence. Okay, so they're trying to get you to go beyond parts and really consider the whole of things. And then the next statement is, the universe of universes is one vast integrated mechanism which is absolutely controlled by one infinite mind. That should remind you of something we did a while back in paper 42. Very important sentence in the book to kind of have at the tip of your mind. One of the reasons why they said the universe of universes there, wrote it out like that. In that sentence there in paper 42, it says the universe of universes in toto is mind planned, mind made, and mind administered. Oh yeah, it does seem like they're in that mode, doesn't it? Which is absolutely controlled by one infinite mind. If people are wondering where that is, that's page 481. It's section 11, the second paragraph of section 11 in paper 42. Yeah, see, and it even starts out, mechanisms do not absolutely dominate the total creation. See, it even mentions mechanisms there, just like they did here. Right? And when it says the universe of universes in toto, right, in toto is in italics, what does that mean? It means the universe of universes as a whole. Right? Not the parts, but as a whole is mind planned, mind made, and mind administered. Right? We're wanting to think about the whole. Right? And what's directly related to wholeness, not partness? The father is the individuality of the parts, and the mother is the individuality of the whole. When they say one infinite mind, you're going, oh, they're talking about the universal father. No, the universal father is not the infinite mind. The infinite mother spirit is the infinite mind, capital I, capital M. As you see when we get in a ways, right, the moment you bring in mind, you've turned your eyes away from the Father. Right? And they're taking you, all the way to another side of things. The infinite mother spirit. Mother is the source of mind. Do you invoke a contemplation of the whole when you bring in the mother, but you bring in mind, and hence when you bring in mind, you are in some way bringing in the whole. And in a very simple way, you can think of two parts of matter and spirit, the two substances, right? And the super additive consequence is mind energy. And immediately you just have this seemingly a third part, but at the same time you get that third part, you get an encompassment and you get a wholeness. They're in various ways. They're bringing in the mother, they're bringing in mind, they're bringing in the whole. And the one other little thing is absolutely controlled by one infinite mind. Yeah. The third source and center, on the one hand, you can go all the way to a highest level and speak of the infinite spirit or the infinite mother spirit, but you can also talk about the absolute mind, the conjoint actor, right? Absolutely controlled. That's also an aspect of that. So you not only have, when you go to that other side, you not only have the infinite mind, you have the absolute mind. Okay, and then the next thing they say is the physical, intellectual, and spiritual domains of universal creation are divinely correlated. Okay, the threefold actuality is divinely correlated. Divinity is deity-likeness. What's the one facet of deity that directly engages the threefold actuality as a triunity, that correlated threefold actuality, the Paradise Trinity, the whole? So they're invoking triunity. One way that you might, if you said unity, maybe it's referring to the threefold actuality together as one. Maybe it's referring to the triunity of universal reality. But obviously when you say the fundamental quality of deity is unity, you're using unity in a different way than that. All these different ways that you use the word unity. So they've got you, see, in that mode where you've got physical, intellectual, spiritual, you got these three parts, but they're reminding you that there's always a wholeness, that those are within, the parts are within. And any way you want to think about parts, there's a wholeness that they're within. They go on and say the perfect and the imperfect are truly interrelated. perfect and imperfect are two different types of parts, two different flavors of parts. Right? They're truly interrelated. Right? They're interrelated in the whole, truly in the whole. Now, what that means there. And therefore, see, unless you unpack it like that, when they say "and therefore," the "therefore" seems nonsensical. I mean, you don't seem to have any sort of deductive reasoning going on that it makes sense for there to be a "therefore" in the sentence. So you got to unpack it like this. See, so because you know that all these parts are within a whole, therefore, may the finite evolutionary creature ascend to paradise in obedience to the universal Father's mandate, be you perfect even as I am perfect. Right? The universal Father is your spiritual Father. He's a spiritual part. I'm a material part. If all there was parts, there's no way a material part has any relationship to a spiritual part. There's no way I could obey that mandate, let alone even hear it, become aware of it. Right? They're reminding you that no matter how much you seem to be diametrically opposite from this individual that is giving you this mandate and demanding, commanding that you follow this mandate and go to the center of all things and personally recognize him in his personal presence, right? The only way that can happen is because no matter how much those two seem completely disjoint and not related, they are. In the whole, they are. Right? The Paradise Trinity and the Mother are the way that those two parts can be connected. So the one part can hear the mandate of the other part and has a way to get to the other part and have a relationship to the other part when it gets there, even before it got there. I mean, how can you get a personality from that part? How can you get a thought adjuster from that part? What related you to that other part right now? The whole. And this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole, the Paradise Trinity, and through the individuality of the whole, the Mother. That's what they're, how they're starting out this paper. So they're going to talk about familiar parts like the Universal Father and the Eternal Son, etc. But the point is not just to be reminded of those fancy parts, but to appreciate how they're parts in a whole. And therefore, there are all kinds of potentials that are not apparent by just considering the parts as parts. Why would a spiritual father have any relationship to a material identity part like me? In the whole, we do. Mind bridges that gap between spirit and matter, and mind is of the Mother, not of the Father. All right. So it's see how they're taking that mandate that captured your imagination way back at the beginning of the book. But they're trying to get you to now step back and reflect on the physics of this, the logic of this, to appreciate the greater beauty of how this all works, and that you're not magically related to that part, and you don't get to that part by some magical process. You certainly don't get to that part by just squinting your eyes really earnestly and willing your way there, right? You're not on the Isle of Paradise where you move from point A to point B volitionally, right? You need that experiential deity for you, the experiential creature, to somehow have a way to get there and to be related to where you're going. All right, let's get the other paragraph of the preface here.
The diverse levels of creation are all unified in the plans and administration of the architects of the master universe. To the circumscribed minds of time-space mortals, the universe may present many problems and situations which apparently portray disharmony and indicate absence of effective coordination. But those of us who are able to observe wider stretches of universal phenomena and who are more experienced in this art of detecting the basic unity which underlies creative diversity and of discovering the divine oneness which overspreads all this functioning of plurality, better perceive the divine and single purpose exhibited in all these manifold manifestations of universal creative energy.
Okay. Another one that's, once you're awakened to all the details of the revelation, you're reading, it's like, oh my goodness, they're just dancing with all kinds of things here. So let's go back and slow it down and think about all the things that they're invoking between the lines. So that first statement, the diverse levels of creation are all unified in the plans and administration of the architects of the master universe. Okay, so just as you have something you can initially gauge there. You remember, oh yeah, the architects of the master universe are these absonite beings. Okay, so they're transcendent to the finite of all the diverse levels of creation. So they have some very objective top-down point of view on all this. And okay, I guess that makes sense. But think about it, see if you can think about it more literally, exactly how this comes to be. When they say the diverse levels of creation, a simple way to think about the levels is like, well, I don't know, when I think of levels in some very general sense, how about like the levels of the sevenfold? And as I think about that, I think, well, where the rubber meets the road level, I've got the Creator Sons and the Creative Mother Spirits. I've got the Ancients of Days above that. I've got the Master Spirits above that. Yes. Okay, together, all those beings are called the Supreme Creators, the diverse levels of creation. All right? By the hands of the Supreme Creators. I also have, transcendently encompassing the totality of the finite, I have the Supreme Being. And if you consider the Supreme Creators and the Supreme Being and the architects of the Master Universe, and those are individuals, so I'm considering from the individuality viewpoint, there's a trinity, an experiential trinity related to all those beings. The ultimate trinity, right, has those members, right? Trinity. There's another wholeness there. And the whole hierarchy of various modes of wholeness, right? The ultimate trinity would supply a wholeness. All right, see, the diverse levels of creation are all unified. What is that coordinate wholeness that leads to what they're describing there? It's because the architects are coordinated with the Supreme Being and the Supreme Creators, right? That there can be this, it all works together seamlessly in this wonderful system. There's a system of associations. There's a coordination. There's a wholeness because of the ultimate trinity. And if you want to directly speak of the unity of that trinity, instead of calling it the ultimate trinity, you call it the trinity ultimate, right? From the unity viewpoint. Right? It fits into this universal unity that we're talking about here. So they're invoking another aspect of universal unity, the Trinity ultimate. And then it goes on to say, okay, but you don't have that kind of incredible transcendent objectivity. You're just a lowly little part just getting started in a very big space. And to the circumscribed minds of time-space mortals, the universe may present many problems and situations which apparently portray disharmony and indicate absence of effective coordination. I don't believe in the whole and the individuality of the whole. I don't see any coordination. Well, there really is. Right? That's, you know, apparently portray. There's the appearance of disharmony, but there isn't really disharmony. It's appearance, not reality. Right? The reality is there's a universal harmony. There's a cosmos. Right? No matter how much it doesn't appear so, you've got to know there really is. Right? There's the mother. There's a universal harmony. Right? That's the reality. Despite all appearances to the contrary, you've got to know that. Never not know that. Because the moment you stop believing in that is when you start to despair, right? At all the many problems and situations, right, that confront you, right, that appear to speak of chaos, right, as the reality behind everything instead of cosmos. Right? No, there is an effective coordination. The coordinating influence is always transcendent of any parts you're considering, so it's always effective. It can't not be effective because it's transcendent. There's no parts below that transcendent level that it can't deal with. Right? And if it can't deal with certain parts, it's because those parts are above it, but there is a transcendence above those parts, right, that coordinates. There's always a transcendent coordination all the way up to the Trinity Infinite. So there's always coordination. Deity is universally coordinated no matter how high up you go. All right, and they just go on and remind you, if you have a greater awareness of the big picture, if you aren't so immature, if you start to become an adult of God instead of a child of God, you begin to be more experienced in the art of detecting the basic unity which underlies creative diversity. You begin to recognize the whole and the individuality of the whole, the presence of that universal unity. And you you take great comfort in knowing that, right? That no real harm can befall you, right? Because there's no way that any part can ever get lost, you know, in the seemingly infinite sea of parts, right? It's like, I'm going to get missed eventually. Who can keep track of all these parts, you know? No, you'll never get lost, you know, from the top down. Right? You will always be known very intimately and always be perfectly coordinated with all those infinite numbers of parts. And then it starts to get a little advanced in what they're invoking between the lines. Right? It's like, okay, you've kind of convinced me, at least hypothetically here, that we're talking about the Paradise Trinity and the Mother, the whole and the individuality of the whole. But what about what they say next? It says, and of discovering the divine oneness, which overspreads all this functioning of plurality, better perceive the divine and single purpose exhibited in all these manifold manifestations of universal creative energy. Well, right at the end, it's like, wait a minute, universal creative energy. Okay, you got the three energies. There's only one facet of deity that directly engages the threefold energy system as a triunity. Okay, but oneness and purpose? Does that relate to the Paradise Trinity? Notice, you know, that which overspreads all this functioning of plurality. They're in a very high sweeping mode. Yes. The paradise, one of the things that you can eventually discover when you unpack total deity, one of the things that we unpack in the total deity seminar, is when all is said and done, you finally discover a very transcendent designation for the paradise trinity as an individuality. The co-infinite one. There's a oneness there. Very, very transcendent oneness. The co-infinite one. You know, so transcendent of absolute, super absolute oneness. So transcendent of any oneness on the absolute level, like with seven absolutes. Or even like God the Absolute or something like that. There is a oneness. You'll have to just kind of take my word for that. You certainly can't deduce that in a couple seconds. But that purpose thing, without working through all the stuff that can lead you to that recognition. Because you're thinking, oh, wait a minute, you often talk about your personality is your purposing, Chris, don't you? You often speak of personality as a purposing. And well, we know the Paradise Trinity is not only not personalized, it's not personalizable. Well, I just gave you a hint. It's like, well, that's all fine and dandy, those sorts of statements, when you're talking about the absolutes and below, but what happens when you go super absolute? Things are, you know, not as straightforward. And you can see them referring to that fact right at the very end of paper 118, which is on single column page 1307. Right? At the very end, the very last sentence, paper 118, says, and in infinity, I'll remember how they used that totality of reality infinity thing up there in the foreword when I read that passage about the Paradise Trinity, how it engages infinity, totality of reality. And in infinity, we believe there is the same providence. There is the same providence. And this is the will, the actions, the purpose of the Paradise Trinity, thus motivating the cosmic panorama of universes upon universes. Okay. Even the word will comes into play here in a very transcendent way. When you get up that high to the Paradise Trinity. Motivating the cosmic panorama, purpose. That's what they were just referring to. You can, you know, as you mature, you can better perceive the divine and single, remember it's the co-infinite one, right? Single purpose, the will, the actions, the purpose of the Paradise Trinity exhibited in all these manifold manifestations. Right, that whole bit of thus motivating the cosmic panorama, like they say there. Yep.
Well, you've indicated this is comforting.
Initially, it might be kind of disconcerting because it's very vast. Okay,
yeah, but it all depends on the choice you make. Because we have free will, we have a choice. We can't escape.
Yep.
If we choose, we might be comforted. But if we are free to choose otherwise, right?
Mm.
Because I think, well, what purpose can I have if everything is dominated by this overarching?
This overarching, co-infinite purposing, yes.
And there's beings a lot higher than me who have said, I don't
want to
go with this program.
That's for those in the webinar. He's just, he's thinking about how do I ultimately have genuine free will in the midst of such super absolute purposing? You know, there's all these infinite beings and all this, and again, that's why it's very important that there's an absolute dimension to your personality. Because even in the midst of infinity, absoluteness stands unmoved. Right? You actually can make a place because of that absolute dimension of your personality, even in the midst of all their infinity. If you so choose, you will not be washed away as a drop of water in even an infinite ocean like that, an infinitely functioning infinite ocean. Right? Infinite ocean is one thing, but an infinitely functioning at every point, right? Infinite ocean, right? You can stand unmoved even in the presence of infinite functioning. That's the power of absoluteness, that potential. You've been given the potential to be part of eternity and infinity, to be able to remain individuated. But there's, of course, that level of creativity comes with an equal level of destructivity. Right? And so, like, you know, when I said it's a comfort, it also should be a little bit of a cautionary tale, yes, a little bit of a warning. Like, you know, so more of that mystery monitor aspect of, right, the Father fragment, the divine secret that warns, the mystery monitor, little gentle reminder, right, that there is a whole period. You either synchronize with it or you don't exist. Right? Right, there's no in between. Ultimately, there's no in between. Right? That could be a little scary to your self-righteousness, but it ought to be a little scary to your self-righteousness. That's the whole point.
Even on a much more level, it's logical because God can give me absolute free will, but that doesn't mean He's going to create a whole universe where my free will is absolute over the universe.
Right.
I live within a universe.
Right. Yeah. The scope of your that absolute dimension of your personality is very, very, very small. Right. The only way you can use that absolute dimension is to guarantee that you, your mindful self, period, nothing else. Is part of eternity. And, you know, you're only absolutely sovereign within the confines of your mind or self, not outside. But there, you are sovereign, period. It's completely up to you whether or not that mind or self is a part of eternity or not. And no infinite being has even one iota of say over it. Ultimately, you have absolute say. You know, and that works both ways. No matter how much the Universal Father absolutely desires you to be part of eternity, He can't force you. You're absolutely sovereign over your mind or self, whether that self is part of eternity. So in the midst of an absolute desire for you to be there, you can say absolutely no. You overrule the Father. He's given you a little measure of that kind of authority. Right? Where did your personality come from? Okay. Over that little bit of the totality of reality, you have absolute final say. He's delegated the absolute final say over that little bit of the totality of reality. He no longer possesses it. There's absolutely nothing to ultimately say about that. You know, only you do. Is there anything on the webinar we need to deal with? Or?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to understand, but Chris, is the purposing, this is Winston, is the purposing that we are looking for transcending, that due to this, then, because there is an absoluteness of our personality, we are connected by this potential, and we should not fear.
I mean, yeah, just in the midst of all the complexities, you can always know that no real harm can befall you unless you absolutely want it to. And if you don't absolutely want it to, okay, finitely, absentitely doesn't matter. It's only if you absolutely want real harm to befall you, will it? Right? So as long as you're sincere, everything comes out in the end, right? No matter how much error and evil you stumble upon and whatnot in our ignorant little child of God lives, right? There's no absolute willingness for that to be what you are relative to eternity. It's infinitely removed from iniquity. Right, such ignorant error and evil, infinitely removed from iniquity. Right? To get to iniquity is to cross an infinite distance. It's not an easy task, especially in a few short years of ignorant living on this planet. Right? Right? No matter how hard you run, you probably can't run an infinite distance. So just don't worry about it.
Forget about it.
Right? But yes, I mean, obviously, with an absolute dimension, I could run an infinite distance. Right? Quote, unquote, you know, metaphorically. Right? We're having a hard time even using the finite dimensions of our personality in this brief, ignorant life, let alone anything transcendent of that. Right? So forget about it. Right? It's just, you know, I mean, if you have any shred of sincere desire, there's nothing to be afraid of. Right? You're not going to get, you're not going to stumble into an infinite distance, right? Whoops, I just journeyed an infinite distance without thinking about it. No, that doesn't happen. Right?
Look what that tadpole just did.
So, big feet. All right.
They mentioned divine and single purpose.
Yeah. Right, and see, it's just exhibited in all these manifold manifestations of universal creative energy. Right? See, they're trying to remind you that there's all kinds of things that the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are doing, and, you know, and all kinds of other beings and whatnot. But overarching all of that, right, is a single purpose that exists in relationship to the whole. There's a single purposing of the whole. There's all kinds of purposing of parts, but one single purposing of the whole. Right? All the parts don't have any say about the purposing of the whole. Right? I mean, to bring it down to a smaller scale, to just the finite, encompassing the finite is the supreme being, the supreme one. Right? There's a oneness there. And like I say many times, there is no set of finite facts that the supreme mind can't deal with. And no matter what, how much willing goes on, how much purposing goes on of all those parts, creating a big complex set of finite phenomena, right, the supreme mind encompasses all that. It's transcendent of all that, can deal with any set of finite facts. Right? And we're just taking that all the way up, you know, to the limits. You know, and thinking about one of the parts being the universal Father, and one of the parts being, no matter what all those parts, you know, do, there's something that encompasses all of that partness and all of its part-wise willing, right? And there's one single purpose of the whole, right? And the Universal Father instantly recognized that as soon as he came into existence, and the first thing he did was put himself in cooperative subordination to the whole, because he has no say over the whole. He's a part. Right? And that's what we all have to do. That's what our Creator Son did over a billion years and seven bestowals, got himself into cooperative subordination to the whole, the Paradise Trinity. And each of us as fine owlers take an oath to the Paradise Trinity, an oath that we are in cooperative subordination to the whole. Right? I humbly serve the whole as a sincere, dutiful part, knowing I have no say over the divine and single purpose of the whole. It just is. And I'm finding my place in that purposing of the whole as a part.
Seems pretty godlike. That's the malaise that's happening in society right now. People don't feel connected. They feel there's, they drop out because they don't feel there's anything worth connecting to. Or they feel lost.
So I said, this should comfort you. There, no matter how much it appears there is no whole, there is. And you can find your place in it. You can consecrate yourself to being a loyal part of that whole. Okay? Loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. Okay? It's all relative to the whole. And just one little aside, asterisk, footnote, why isn't the Father the whole? Because if the Father was the whole, there wouldn't be any parts. The part and the whole would be the same thing, and there, that would be it. And there wouldn't even be a part called the Father, right? God the Father. There would only be God the Infinite. No father, no mother, no sons, no children. By the way, did you notice up there in paper 196 and the child of the center and source, right? You're a son of the source and center. You're a child of the center and source. Right? You're a child of the mother, a son of the father. See, they're always very precise like that. okay, so, right, so we're trying to understand universal unity. Right? Something so universal where the seven absolutes are parts. Right? Especially that first source and center is even a part. Yeah, and just know that there's always a way that you can, no matter how deep you go, like I said, if you have to, you can actually go transcendent to the Paradise Trinity, right, and go all the way up to the Trinity Infinite, right? But there's always Trinity. There's always a whole in which whatever you're thinking about is coordinated. Okay, so then we start with the first section here, and they had a lot of fun with the section titles. So you see, this one's called physical coordination, you flip to the next one, and it's intellectual unity, and then it's spiritual unification, and then it's personality unification. So you see matter, mind, spirit, and personality, just like the threefold actuality with unity chart, right? But you notice how one's coordination, then it's unity, then it's unification, and unification again. We'll talk about each of those as we get to them. But this first one, remember, a coordination is a system of associations. Systematized associations. Right? If you're going to have associations, you've got to have individuality. Right? You have individualities that are associated. Right? We're talking about physical. Right? Matter is the substance that directly expresses individuality, for instance. Right? So you have all this individuality. It's associated, and there needs to be a coordination. A systematizing of all those associations. So that's why they used physical coordination there. Right? There's nothing very inherently unity about individuality. It's diametrically opposite, right? Threefold. Right? So we're talking about individuality, so we're talking about its coordination, physical coordination. So let's see what they say here.
One, physical coordination. The physical or material creation is not infinite, but it is perfectly coordinated. There are force, energy, and power, but they are all one in origin. The seven super universes are seemingly dual, the central universe triune, but paradise is of single constitution. And paradise is the actual source of all material universes, past, present, and future. But this cosmic derivation is an eternity event. At no time, past, present, or future, does either space or the material cosmos come forth from the nuclear Isle of Light. As the cosmic source, paradise functions prior to space and before time. Hence would its derivations seem to be orphaned in time and space, did they not emerge through the unqualified absolute, their ultimate repository in space, and their revealer and regulator in time.
Okay. So, bunch of things here again. So just focusing on the one aspect of the threefold actuality, physical or material creation, as they say there at the beginning. And we're thinking about it from our time viewpoint perspective, trying to understand it. We definitely don't see the cosmos infinite, and it's not because we don't have powerful enough telescopes. Right? There's no cosmos infinite to be observed, you know, from a finite point of view, no matter how powerful the telescope is. It's a finite point of view. So infinite doesn't fit into the finite. Right? So they start out with that, and then what's the next thing they say? But it is perfectly coordinated. Okay, well, one way, just in the way we've been talking about, there's always this deity presence that is coordinating, be it Paradise Trinity or the Mother. But there's another thing to remind yourself. That's why I brought up the cosmos infinite. In eternity, there is the cosmos infinite. And from that top-down point of view, you understand that the finite domain that you're in is, in terms of the physical domain, is a downstepped expression of that cosmos infinite. And that cosmos infinite is obviously perfectly coordinated in infinity and eternity and absoluteness. So when you downstep, it can't help but have the truth of that fact, right? It is perfectly coordinated. See, it's not, in this sense, it's not just, perfecting even. It's just perfectly coordinated, right? In truth, the truths of eternity, it's perfectly coordinated. But you're not going to see that as a fact, right? Yeah, what do they say up above? Apparently portray disharmony and indicate absence of effective coordination, right? But it's there in truth. And again, the truth is like I mentioned up there when they said truly interrelated. That's interrelated in the whole, right? As a whole, it's perfectly coordinated, but not as a part or even a collection of parts. And as a whole, it is. So in truth, it is. Okay, and then they try to motivate this recognition of wholeness by considering some aspects about the parts that you've been taught. We know, like when we were going through paper 42, that we referred to just a little bit ago, you had force and energy and power. you know, as an evolutionary sequence, going from primordial force to emergent energy to universe power. And they say, but they're all one in origin. See, so they're reminding you that, you know, it's not surprising that all of the complexity of force, energy, and power that's existent right now could have some sort of a coordination to it. If you just think about it causally, and you, it goes back to one in origin, right? Everything is coming out of one reservoir, the unqualified absolute. Right? First it's force, then it's energy, and then it's power. And so, you know, you can logically, it must have shades of its singular origin, you know, no matter how complex it gets. And then, you know, then they talk about some of these things. You know, notice the seven universes are seemingly dual. You're going, what, seemingly dual? I thought they were dual. I thought they say that very definitively, right? That the physical stuff is dual here and triune in the central universe. Well, the reason they say seemingly is, if you just think about it, it's like, well, okay, it's dual. However, I have noticed, especially like when we went through the previous paper, that the more we go along, the more we're not talking about the dual government. It's all getting replaced by Trinity government. Right? It's all becoming more and more coordinate, and it's more and more Trinity administration, like the super universe, and not dual like the local universe. And so it's like, yeah, but we're not talking about administration. You know, we're talking about physical energy here. Right? But what's the the central universe is the pattern universe, and it's triune. Right? See, so yeah, they're saying it's suggestive that, well, it's dual now, but what happens when the grand universe is settled in light and life? Then what becomes of it all? Right? Is it really dual if you look at it from the eternity viewpoint? If you look at it from the time viewpoint, it's dual. Right? That's the appearance. But is it the reality, you know, in a very transcendent sense? Is it the reality? Like from the eternity viewpoint? I'm just tossing that in between the lines, they couldn't resist. And then they bring up that whole bit about, remember when we were talking about way, way, way back about the Isle of Paradise? And we often kind of just, you know, speak of that space, you know, comes from or stems from, has its origin from the Isle of Paradise. I mean, they call it the Paradise Source and Center, after all, right? Source. And they're reminding you that. I mean, of course, remember, it's in eternity, not in time. Right? So it's not like it's a source, literally. You know, you're watching the Isle of Paradise, and at a certain point on your watch, blurp, you know, out comes space or something, right? Or, you know, oh, there's the Andromeda Galaxy, just came out of it. You know, that's not the way it works, right? All right, so there's no time, past, present, or future. Right? It's an eternity event. But they are reminding you that both space and physical energies do have this anchoring back, or, you know, stemming from sense relative to the Isle of Paradise. And remember, do you remember, you know, how we, you know, kind of talked about that some? And they're reminding you of that here when they say, after they say as the cosmic source. You see, so as the source out here in the cosmos, paradise functions prior to space and before time. You see, and that's, you know, hence would its derivation seem to be orphaned in time and space? Did they not emerge through the unqualified absolute? You know, you can remind yourself of back when they were talking about the Isle of Paradise, when they said the same thing. That's right at the top of single column, page 120. Isle of Paradise is paper 11, section 2, like right in the middle of section 2. At the end of a paragraph, you'll see We hardly conceive of the unqualified absolute as a person, but we do think of the functional space presence of this absolute as focalized on nether paradise. Okay, so you have physical stuff coming out of the reservoir of potential that is the unqualified absolute, and then you have this reminder that the unqualified absolute, you know, is focalized on nether paradise. Okay, but right there, you may recall this, you know, you notice a curious word, but we think of the functional space presence of this absolute. Okay, you're going, well, wait a minute, the unqualified absolute is a reservoir of potential, it doesn't function. What are they doing between the lines there? They're reminding you. Flip it around to the unity viewpoint. What's the facet of deity that is associated here with the unqualified absolute? That's the infinite capacity, that facet of deity called the infinite capacity. And it functions. Deity functions. Oh, yeah, you know, we started out deity is universally coordinated. See, in between the lines, they are trying to get you to think about deity, even though they're just talking about the unqualified absolute. That's really not the point. It's a means to a greater end to think about deity functioning and how that deity functioning is focalized on nether paradise. All right, that's a coordinating influence that's focalizing. Coordinate action is focalization. Right? They're reminding you of the Trinity, right? In this coordinating mode, physical coordination, right, leads to that focalization on the aisle, and out here it leads to everything these parts having an overarching wholeness to what's going on, a divine and single purpose to it all, for instance. You got something?
No? Yeah. You say that would be Trinity. Wouldn't that be a triodity?
No. We're talking about something that can coordinate. The triunities and the triodities are a whole bunch of different threefold coordinations. Coordinated by what? What coordinates, you know, say the three absolutes of potentiality into the triodity of potentiality, the Paradise Trinity, right? What coordinates these threefold associations? Right? What makes them a system of associations? It's always the Paradise Trinity. For those of you who are familiar, you might remember in the Paradise Trinity paper, they talk about it's functioning, and there's totality attitudes, coordinate action, cosmic over-control, and that coordinate action, that's vocalization, womb focalizer, upholder. For those of you who are familiar, you know, have some relationship to the Total Deity Seminar, some of this stuff is familiar. See, they're invoking all this sort of stuff between the lines. The more you have unpacked all this and put this all, synthesized all this together, the more you understand what they're referring to here. But back to paper 56, just like we saw with them throwing in the functioning thing in the midst of talking about the unqualified absolute there with the Isle of Paradise, look what they did here. You know, so they say, you know, did they not emerge through the unqualified absolute? Their ultimate repository in space. It's like, okay, that's obviously talking about the reservoir, right? The unqualified absolute is a reservoir. But then it says, and their revealer and regulator in time? Since when do their reservoir of potential function as a regulator or a revealer? Right? So again, they flipped you around. The functioning of the infinite capacity. Right, the facet of deity that's associated with that, that individuality, the unqualified absolute. So again, they're just reminding you that you've got deity is universally coordinated. If you want to really understand the coordination, you have to flip things around to the deity perspective, and then think about Trinity coordinating deity. And then that coordinated deity, if you flip it back around to the reality perspective and have all the individuality, right, you'll see that kind of magically there's this providence, quote unquote, like we read there. It seems like magically all the parts are coordinated, and there's no hands holding on to them, you know, getting them into a system of associations. Right? Because it's coming from deity, but manifesting as an apparently magical, providential reality. But of course, it isn't magical. Right? There's deity and there's coordination.
And there's it's living. It's not. This coordination is evidence, like a. An organism, a body, mm-hmm. is a living body. Mm-hmm. Things are coordinated. Mm-hmm. And this whole is a living whole. It's not a static, dead whole.
Yeah, exactly.
It's living. Right. For
those of you on the webinar, he's bringing up that recognition of living. You know, there's a livingness to reality as well, because there's life animation. You know, in the midst of all this coordination, you know, that's why you can speak of the universe as an organism, right? Yeah. An organism indicates there's a wholeness. It's not just a part, it's a bunch of parts in a wholeness. Right? Parts in a whole is an organism. A virus is a part, but a bacterium is an organism. And I'm a very complex organism. There's a wholeness, and to not just focus like current science does on all the physics of all the parts, and how they interact, in twofold part to part fashion. But there's a wholeness, and there's physics just of the wholeness, and then there's the whole. Pardon the pun. Transcendent. Physics of the parts, because they're in that wholeness, right? The super additive consequences in a system, right? Everything relates is in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole, that it's related part to part. And there's more than just two parts. There's three or more, you got a system. And so it says all that complexity, but we're... But they're just trying to get you to, in this, like I said, just leveraging off of one of the seven absolutes here, the unqualified absolute, to begin to reflect on the bigger picture, the deity, and hence the deity is universally coordinated. And so there's going to be a physical coordination. And all of eternity and time and everything, it's all transcended and coordinated together. In truth, the Isle of Paradise is a source, even though in time it's not in fact a source, like they said. The transcendent of all that, there's a coordination, there's a wholeness. Okay, let's keep going here.
The unqualified absolute upholds the physical universe, while the deity absolute motivates the exquisite overcontrol of all material reality. And both absolutes are functionally unified by the universal absolute. This cohesive correlation of the material universe is best understood by all personalities, material, Marantia, absonite, or spiritual, by the observation of the gravity response of all bona fide material reality to the gravity centering on Nether Paradise.
Okay, they're invoking quite advanced things here. Just taking it on face value, you don't feel much resonance with exactly what they're talking about. I mean, okay, they're talking about the three absolutes and gravity, and yet they seem to be talking about some very profound sorts of things. I don't really understand the physics of what they're talking about here. That's because it's not to be found in the immediacy of what's there. But there's all kinds of hints again. Right? You start out, the unqualified absolute upholds. Reservoirs don't uphold. While the DD absolute motivates. Reservoirs don't motivate. Let alone the exquisite over-control of all material reality. And both absolutes are functionally unified by the universal absolute. Again, there's no functioning of a reservoir, the universal absolute. It must be, they're invoking deity. And again, the more sophisticated you are, the more you notice what they're getting at. Because when you flip the universal absolute around, you get the infinite upholder, and yet they've got the upholds there with the unqualified absolute. And the more you recognize it, it seems like they've got these things kind of jumbled together. They've got over control with the deity absolute, instead of the universal absolute. And what they're invoking there is, when you flip things around to the deity viewpoint, and you think about those expressions of those three facets of deity working together as one, that's mother deity. They're invoking mother deity, not the Paradise Trinity now. Now they're actually invoking mother deity. That womb focalizer, upholder. Okay. With those three different phases of deity together in relationship to the sourcing functioning of the Paradise Trinity. They're reminding you of, accept in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole, the mother. They're reminding you of how you want to really get to the details of how this is coordinated. It's through the mother, right? And through her, this internal threefold functionality that you can flip around and think about. It has relationship to those reservoirs. And so when you look at the threefold actuality of universal reality, all three types of energy will have this amazing coordination together, right? Because the mother has an immediate synchronization with all three together as one. Okay, so there's that. Again, you kind of have to just take my word for this, because to literally get to this point of recognition is what we do in unpacking the logic of total deity in the Total Deity Seminar. Notice how they are definitely referring to the triunity of the threefold actuality when they say this cohesive correlation, cohesion, and is stuck together, literally. The co is together, and the root means to stick. Right? Stuck together is one, the threefold actuality of these three energies coming out of those three different reservoirs. So then they go on and say something very mysterious about how this is best understood by personalities of all flavors, by the observation of the gravity response of all bona fide material reality to the gravity centering of nether paradise. What on earth? Again, this is a very advanced thing that they're invoking there. We bring out in the Total Deity Seminar eventually. It's one thing to consider the three absolutes, the three reservoirs of potential, from the time viewpoint. It's another very enlightening thing to consider the association of the three from the eternity viewpoint, which is what they're invoking here. To really understand that, they're thinking about the three absolutes from the eternity viewpoint, and what you discover about the unqualified absolute from that viewpoint, and how that relates to, you notice how the gravity centering on Nether Paradise? There's a little bit of a sort of a pun there. You know, it's one thing to think about, like we were just talking about, that focalized on Nether Paradise, right? And you might think it's just referring to that. But remember how when we talk about absolute gravity, the absolute gravity presence, that's a centering influence. You know, so not only is this sort of centered on Nether Paradise, but there's a centering influence that stems from Nether Paradise and is manifest universally. That centering influence, think about just the simplest way that you would, you know, you kind of get a sense of what they're talking about. It's like, okay, if I have a whole bunch of blobs of matter in the presence of that universal centering influence, it all collects together into a sphere. Right? It all gets unified into a sphere. It all gets stuck together. The cohesive correlation. It all gets stuck together by that centering influence into a sphere of matter. So just that kind of unifying of parts into a single object, you know, gets you going with this, but like I'm saying, there's much deeper going on there with this tension presence that you can understand from the eternity viewpoint of the unqualified absolute. Right? And that there's this tension presence, this centering influence, right, that seems to want to unify parts, right, into a single object. Okay, so see, in various ways, they're taking what you have some familiarity with, and trying to put it together in a sequence that gets you to feel universal unity. And so, even in your very initial relationship to what's being stated here, you should be able to get something that kind of gets you to feel some of the truth of universal unity. But like I said, if you want to really feel it, so you've got to go, you know, there's a lot of depth here to appreciate. But let me just say something right now that I haven't said yet about the title of the paper. Why are they going through all this? They're invoking some, you know, they mention God, and that reminds you of religion, and they mention, you know, gravity, and that reminds you of science, and you remember how in various places in the Revelation, they use that expression, universal unity. What's it in relationship to? It's that desire of the philosophic exercise. Right? The philosopher is seeking a comprehension of universal unity. Universal unity is fundamentally about philosophy, not about science or religion. It's transcendent of that, right? It's about the wholeness, transcendent of the spirit parts or the material parts. So very much we are, you know, this paper, you know, is a philosophic paper. Universal unity is a philosophic issue, not a religious issue or a scientific issue. It's the pithy way that you express, you know, just like science will search for the first cause, right? Philosophy searches for universal unity, the recognition and comprehension of how there is a universal unity despite all of the parts and, like, you know, like they said, the apparent disharmony, right, of all those parts. It's the recognition the Greeks had, they started up philosophy, that it can't really be chaos. They imagined that in the beginning there was chaos, and then a great influence took hold, and cosmos manifested in contrast to chaos, right? A universal harmony and not chaos. And they knew the universal unity was there to be found if they could just focus themselves well enough and search earnestly enough. It was something that could be discovered and recognized, and your life could be predicated on that fact, the existence of that. Right? That's the philosophic quest. All right. So back here to what they say. Again, they're going to try to give us something to play off of that we know that they've talked about in other places.
Gravity unification is universal and unvarying. Pure energy response is likewise universal and inescapable. Pure energy, primordial force, and pure spirit are wholly pre-responsive to gravity. These primal forces, inhering in the absolutes, are personally controlled by the Universal Father. Hence does all gravity center in the personal presence of the Paradise Father of pure energy and pure spirit and in his supermaterial abode.
Okay, so they're going to try to leverage off of what they've said about the Universal Father. Again, like I said, starting with the seven absolutes of infinity, they're trying to use them suggestively, metaphorically, analogously, whatever, to get you to appreciate a bigger picture. Like I said, even in the simplest sense, where you think about a bunch of dirt clods collecting into a giant ball called a planet, right? to speak of that as gravity unification, like they did there, and how it's universal and unvarying. And then they toss in contrast, pure energy response is likewise universal and inescapable. Okay, remember, pure energy, like they say there, is primordial force, the force charge of space. And it's a universe of motion. In the same way that the appearance of gravity is an inward phenomenon, the presence of the force charge of space is an outward phenomenon. Remember how we talked about that? It's a fundamentally an outward motion, an outward scalar motion. It's universal. It's the same everywhere. It's outward everywhere. It's not vectorial, where it's just outward from that one point in the universe. No, it's outward from every point in the universe. It's not vectorial, it's scalar. So you got to see, so they're just giving you, on one hand you have this sort of universal inwardness, you also have a universal outwardness. Why did they do that? Well, they're trying to transition you over to the Father, and that thing we often talk about is that you've got this amazing recognition that you finally have that pure energy and pure spirit, pure energy, the primordial force, what's the parenthetical on pure spirit? That's the Father fragments. Mm-hmm. Right? That they're one and the same personal ministry of the Universal Father. You take the primordial force and you flip it around, you've got the Father fragments. And you flip them around, you've got the force charge of space. I mean, they're one and the same thing. They're not two things, they're one thing viewed from two opposite perspectives. Okay? And again, why are they doing this? Because they want to motivate why there would be universal coordination. It's like, well, from an individuality viewpoint, you can go back pre-responsive to gravity. You can go back before the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Sun, back before a separation into two, you know, and just the singularness of the first source and center prior to the paradise source and center and the second source and center. You know, and in that, in him, they are one. And then see how they're also, by doing that, and you're thinking about, well, primordial force comes out of the universal absolute reservoir, and you know, we think about the deity absolute is a reservoir of the potential for spirit substance, and so, they're trying to link this together as oneness, you know, to the absolutes, and you know they link the absolutes into the mother and a coordination, again, kind of giving you a, well, how could I understand why the mother encompassing that threefoldness would tend to coordinate everything together into a harmony? Well, if I think about it relative to the Father, it all comes back to one thing together, right? There's no separation. So the quote-unquote harmony is innate. It's automatic. When there's no separation, there's nothing to harmonize. It's sort of pre-harmonized, right? When you think about it in the presence of the Father, this threefold actuality is pre-harmonized. And so it motivates how it's harmonizable then, you know? If you think about the first source and center perspective, if it's pre-harmonized, it's got to be, once it's separated, it's got to be subsequently harmonizable. All right. And they're giving you this other linkage at the same time. You've got a person, the conjoint actor, directly related to mind as the absolute mind. You've got a person, the eternal Son, directly related to spirit as the absolute spirit. But you don't have a person, the Isle of Paradise, directly related to matter, right? The Isle of Paradise is not a person. But you can kind of think of the Father as the universal controller, as sort of the person behind that. And there, hence does all gravity center in the personal presence of the Paradise Father, of pure energy and pure spirit, and in his supermaterial abode. So they're playing off of that, but the whole point, again, you just read that and you feel a unity issue when they talk about how those are together as one, as his personal ministry, pure energy and pure spirit. They're throwing out various things to get you to kind of feel universal unity, how even from an individuality viewpoint, even thinking about what you know about parts and their sourcing, it shouldn't be surprising that it could have this coordination to it when all is said and done, out as a whole bunch of parts. But ultimately, you want to go beyond just like, well, if I go back and it's all together as one, I guess it makes sense that there's some sort of a wholeness to it out here. You know, you want to go beyond that and actually recognize it's not just because of the sourcing that there's coordination. There's literally active, present coordination. Right? Because when you go back like this, you're going outside. Right? God the Father is God is transcendence. Right? We don't want it to be, you know, in that kind of non-living, like Gene was saying, predestination sort of a thing. You want it to be genuine, separate parts, and you want a living coordination that's there, intimate with them. You want the God of immanence, not the God of transcendence. You want God the Mother, right, as an active coordinating agency in there, so that there's a place for free will, rather than just some sort of mechanistic, like deism or something like that, right? That just predestines things.
Yeah, that's the only way you'd have to give something that extent of latitude which would require an act of coordination.
Right.
The presence of.
Something has to be imminent with it, coordinating, and that's the mother. The mother's the way there can be that genuine individuality and free will. You know, experiential deity, rather than trying to somehow do it all with existential deity and hence take the life out of it. You know, you end up with just the stasis of existential deity. All right. Okay, you can see they're going to go on with this a little bit more. What do they say?
Pure energy is the ancestor of all relative, non-spirit, functional realities, while pure spirit is the potential of the divine and directive over control of all basic energy systems. And these realities, so diverse as manifested throughout space and as observed in the motions of time, are both centered in the person of the Paradise Father. In him they are one, must be unified, because God is one. The Father's personality is absolutely unified.
You can see I already kind of, you know, brought that out. You know, interesting to note that, you know, back there in paper 42, right before the sentence about the universe, of universes in toto is mind planned, mind made, and mind administered. At the end of the previous paragraph, it says the Paradise Father appears personally in the extra Havona universes only as pure energy and pure spirit. And then, parenthetically, as the thought adjusters and other similar fragmentations. There they have the parenthetical about pure spirit. See, now here we had the parenthetical about pure energy. You see, again, you can see how they're playing off of that, you know, and reminding you what I said. You know, he isn't personally present out here, but there's a personal ministry that's present out here.
Yeah.
Right? And like they say there, the extra Havona universes, he's only personally present as that, is that, together as one personal ministry that is pure energy and pure spirit. Okay. All right. So, like I said, see, they're just, they're just trying to motivate this recognition from the individuality viewpoint that it makes sense that there would be a universal coordination. Like I said, but they're just about to, you know, the other shoe's about to drop. Right? You know, they're about to remind you, but remember, we're just trying to motivate a recognition here. You don't want to go literally with this, or you don't have any parts, you don't even have God the Father, you're just going to have God the Infinite, and everything is just going to be, you know, thoughts in the Godhead of God the Infinite or something here. Because there's an issue here with taking this too literally. They're about to bring that out.
This ends with a statement that God, the Father's personality is absolutely unified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would understand that as meaning he's not conflicted.
Right, he's definitely, yeah, I mean, you can definitely think of it in that simple sense that he's not conflicted. He's absolutely not conflicted. There's no cross currents in his purposing. But another thing to remember about, you know, the Father's personality, you know, that's always in quotes, right? The Father only has personality in quotes because, remember, personality is technically individuated will. Right? You have the reservoir of all will, you individuate a measure of it, and you bestow that measure, right? The Father didn't have personality bestowed on him as individuated will like that. Father, you know, the Father's not technically personality, you know, in that sense, right? He's not the personality absolute. Right. The absolute of bestowed individuated will. Um, But this bit about absolutely unified, the way you can think about that is, you know, if you think about the reservoir of all will as potentially a whole bunch of parts, right, because you're going to individuate it and dole it out, that reservoir is going to divest itself of all these parts, is going to be a delegation of purposing potential. Well, take that all the way to the end, right? Delegate everything that's delegatable. Yeah, bestow every measure of individuatable will, and you've got one kernel left of unindividuatable will, which is effectively, the father of the personality of the father. And I see it's absolutely unified. It's unindividuatable. Again, just like, you know, there is no individuation of matter, mind, and spirit in the, inherent in the Father. I mean, it's pre that separation, right? He has this unindividuatable nature. Right? All the individuatable has been, delegated. And so they're just reminding you that no matter how you look at it, you can look at it from an energy perspective, where pure energy and pure spirit are actually one and the same thing, not two things. Or you can even look at it from the personality perspective, right? He's this essence of pre-harmonization, in that undelegatable core nature. Yeah. So they're invoking that, all the more definitively in this paragraph we just read. But then, like I said, it's like, okay, right, but the whole point is really not to just think about that nature of the Father. Right? The point is to think about how that potential of harmony is related to an actuality of harmony that's actually out there in the cosmos where he isn't. And he's a potential for harmony in the way they're just saying here. It's like this pre-separated and hence, pre-harmonized, beginning sense. It makes it the first source and center, a potential for harmony. Okay. What do they say here next?
In the infinite nature of God, the Father, there could not possibly exist duality of reality, such as physical and spiritual. But the instant we look aside from the infinite levels and absolute reality of the personal values of the Paradise Father, we observe the existence of these two realities and recognize that they are fully responsive to his personal presence. In him, all things consist.
Okay, they're doing it very slowly. So they're not saying totally yet, exactly what you see, but obviously, as I, if I just think about it in the sense of starting with the first source and center, and then next I have the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Sun, I have the Paradise source and center and the second source and center. I've got this absolute of matter on the one hand, and I've got the absolute spirit on the other hand. So the moment I move away, I see the duality. Okay, but you recognize that that there is this, in that sense, causal linkage back to that pre-separated source, the first source and center. We recognize they are fully responsive to his personal presence. If you think about pure energy and pure spirit as being the beginnings of things, like force goes to energy and then to power. Right, everything that results can be traced back, and so in him all things consist. You can think of everything as all standing together, or all placed together in his singularness. All right, so It's like, well, that's actually kind of just saying more of the same. What are they building up to? They seem to be, you know, making it more and more pregnant with every paragraph here. What are they leading up to here? Right?
The moment you depart from the unqualified concept of the infinite personality of the Paradise Father, you must postulate mind as the inevitable technique of unifying the ever-widening divergence of these dual universe manifestations of the original monothetic creative personality, the first source and center, the I Am.
Okay. So they're building up to, in a way, giving you a definition for mind. You see mind in all caps there. All right, the moment that you depart from the immediacy of the Father, you've got mind. You have mind as the means for this wholeness. Mind comes from the mother. The moment that you move away from the Father, you've got the mother. The moment you move away from God as transcendence, you're with God as immanence, right? The moment you move away from outside, you're inside, right? With God the Mother, the source of mind. Now, it may be the infinite mind, like they mentioned at the beginning of the paper, the infinite mother spirit, right? Or maybe it's all the way down to the creative mother spirit, as a downstepped expression, a delegating of that bestower of mind, but it's mother. You've got mother in play. The moment you depart from the unqualified concept of the infinite personality of the Paradise Father, right, you must postulate the mother. And you need some source for that fact. That's going to be the Paradise Trinity. Okay, now there's a bunch of rather complicated things they throw in here too. So you have mind as this inevitable technique for unifying. So you see we've got this unifying influence, even in that initial simple sense where you have two substances, and what is the means for them to be related one to another? Matter and spirit substance, mind energy. So that you don't just have that duality, you have a triunity. And like I said, initially you just have the association of the two, and its direct expression is mind energy, but then you have an encompassment of the three into a whole, the three into a triunity. And the farther you move from the Father, the more this diverges, like they're saying, the more you need lots and lots of this ability to coordinate an ever more definitive partness. Right? I mean, if you just kind of think simply, I start with it all together, and as I move apart, move away, say move away from that source, right? The parts get farther and farther apart, and hence more and more part-like, right? You can't imagine that they're kind of fuzzy parts, and the fuzziness overlaps, so they're really not two parts. I mean, eventually it's like, from where we stand, matter and spirit are so radically separated, it seems inconceivable there could be any relationship between them, right? There's nothing more tangible than me, hitting my head against, a rock. But spirit substance, is so ethereal that it's not even believed in as a substance, right? All right, so it's very, very different. Not at all like what they say, that if you were to go up to the eternal sun and poke his body, and you were to poke the Isle of Paradise, it's like, I don't know. You say that they're absolutely different, but they seem absolutely the same to me, right? Right. So the matter and spirit there, you know, don't seem to be different at all, like they are out here. Okay, so you've got that ever widening, and then they throw in this little parting thing about you know, relative to the original monothetic creator personality, the first source and center, M dash the I am. Now, the more you study, say, paper 105, and you understand that the I am is a concept, not an actuality, you're going, well, they seem to be saying that the first source and center and the I am are synonyms here, aren't they? Well, that may be how it appears, but you know that can't be what they're really doing with that parenthetical, that M dash, can't mean those are synonyms, because that would be refuted by what's in paper 105. What are they doing there? Sometimes they're even more intimate about it. They'll have an expression they'll call the father hyphen I am. Right? Is that a statement that the I am is some sort of an actuality that's glued to the father? You know, and they go around as, you know, together as one? Again, no. I mean, because the I am directly is just a concept, not an actuality. So what are they getting at here with expressions like, or statements like this and expressions like the father hyphen I am? When they say things like this, they're reminding you of how at the deepest level the father has quite an intimacy with that, you know, the essence of that initial concept that you unpack, that you call the I am. You know, they're reminding you of how inherent in the Father there's going to be at the deepest core, at the center of the Father, the first center, there's going to be an intimacy with I am-ness, if you will. If you search for the word monothetic, it occurs in two places. Here, and up in paper 105, in one of the places where they're giving you a litany of descriptions, qualities of the concept of the I am.
That's pretty good.
Okay. What do they mean by monothetic? They are invoking just what they're talking. They've been talking about above. Like when you say the Father I am, you're thinking of energy and spirit together, unseparated, unindividuated. One of the things that's invoked with that. The thetic part means doing. Greek. Okay? There's a singular doingness here. Right? There's not matter and spirit, so there's a twofold doingness. A doingness relative to, like to pure energy, and a doingness relative to pure spirit. No, there's a single, mono doingness. The first source and center is not dithetic. Right? It's monothetic. Just like that homogeneous concept of the I am. Right, there's no difference within that concept. Right, it's a monothetic pre-reality. Okay, there's a conceptually there's a single doingness there. Yeah, you know, there's a potential for singular doingness, and And here, you know, they're reminding you the Father has a very much a, is an actualization of that potential for singular doingness. Right? Because it's the Father in the sense of the individuality viewpoint, you know, there's the first source and center is prior to all separation. Right? There is no threefold actuality. Right? You know, so there isn't a twofold or a threefold doingness. Yeah, the threefold doingness is why you have the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Son and the conjoint actor.
This is a doing that can't be delegated.
Yeah. You obviously can't delegate a doingness where it's all together one to those who can only relate to one of the three parts. And that's, you can't delegate that to them. So that's why it's not delegated. All right, so there's a bit of complexity there. See, when they say the first source and center, M dash the I am, they don't mean it's a synonym. You know, they mean the first source and center in the way that there's a very close intimacy relationship to that concept of the I am. Like I said, same way with the expression Father, I am. And, you know, as we've said many, many times, they're just invoking that there's that sort of, in that pre-harmonized state, you can recognize logically a potential for harmony down the road. Once you split it all apart, right, that which was delegatable, and it got split apart like that, its relationship back to that undelegatable core, you know, seems to suggest that those parts have a potential to be harmonized, right, into a triunity down the way. Okay. And to just stress, like they're doing there, that the key for that to all come to pass when all is said and done is mind. You know, and to think about how that's in that individuality viewpoint of unpacking the I am, how that mind fact is diametrically opposite, if you will, to the Father. Right? You start with the first source and center, you know, and if you put that close to your chest, you know, as a ball, you know, that represents the fact of the first source and center, and then you go out one notch from your chest, and there's now two. There's the Isle of Paradise and the Eternal Sun, or the Paradise source and center, and the second source and center. And then you go out another notch away from your chest, and you have those, that separation being brought back together in the third source and center. Okay? A spirit side and a matter side coming together, a creator side and a controller side coming together. In the third source and center, you know, the conjoint actor, the absolute mind. I see. So in that simple picture, the thing that's most removed at arm's length as you play the story out in front of yourself, see, is mind. Right? Kind of opposite to the Father is mind, right? And you know, it's that mind fact that is the means for the coordination, and that opposite side of things, which is the inside, the way to the inside, whereas the Father is on the totally on the outside. The Father is pure existential deity, pure God as transcendence, pure on the outside. So that's what they're setting up. And this actually does have a little bit of relationship to the triunities and the triodities that you mentioned a little bit ago. Remember the difference between the two. The triunities are the threefold associations where one of them is the Father, the universal Father, or the first source and center. Right, the triodities are the ones not, And it's only when you get to the triodities that you have mind. Right? So it's only when you don't have the Father present that mind can be present. Yeah. Right? And if mind is present, the Father's not present. You know, you can think about it either way. Yep.
What would be the reservoir of third source personality?
The reservoir of third source personality is best thought of as the infinite spirit. You have to be a reservoir, you need the adjective infinite, for those of you who have taken the Total Deity Seminar. The infinite spirit, you know, can be thought of as a reservoir for third source personality. The reservoir for mind activity, you know, is the infinite mind. The reservoir of mind energy itself is the universal absolute. You've got these. You've got some things that you can't understand the reservoir of them from an absolute and sub-absolute perspective. You've got to go super absolute. Personality is one of those things, one of those facts. mind activity, life animation. You know, and doesn't matter if it's first source or third source personality. You know, you really have to think about super absolute stuff, and so you're looking for designations that have the adjective infinite. Yep.
Doesn't this last paragraph here take us directly back to the beginning of the universal unity, the first paragraph? Pretty much.
Right, yeah, you noticed that, you know, that they started out with the universe of universes is one vast integrated mechanism which is absolutely controlled by one infinite mind. That's why it's so appropriate to do what we've done here in one session, because it brings it full circle, right? And then you see what happens, you know, what we'll be doing starting next session is we've got the section on intellectual unity, you know, we'll actually address the mind issue. But they see they wanted to kind of motivate it in this full circle fashion. Right? But in a way, see, I already know the story, right? So I was kind of already speaking of that, you know, right from the very beginning as I was explaining, right? Like I said, I mean, I've already followed the clues. I've already followed the hints that they're giving here and in other places in the book. And, and I'm jumping all over in the book to just show you how you've got those various statements, those various parts that you can eventually see in the context of a whole. Right? And initially, the book is a lot of apparently disjoint parts. You know it isn't really.
Right?
You know it's all a perfect whole. Right? And until you have the big picture perspective, it allows you to take any part and every part, every word, every sentence in the book, and understand it in a holistic fashion, not any ad hoc rationalizations. Well, for this paragraph, I'm going to rationalize it this way, and for that paragraph, I'm going to rationalize it that way. No, one scheme, because until you have that, you know you don't have any true rationalizations. Right? There has to be one picture in which all things come together and make sense. When you're interpreting a single paragraph, you know, anywhere in the book, just in isolation, that interpretation will sound ad hoc and random, but not if I show you that I can use that same thought with every other paragraph in the book, right? Then you begin to okay, this is becoming less and less likely. This is an ad hoc rationalization scheme. I seem to have a universal rationalization. I seem to have found truth. Right? The more that you can get to the point where you don't have to exert yourself at all to interpret it, the interpretation is just self-evident too. Right? It's like you're not struggling to, you know, connect dots. You just look at it, you know, and it's apparent, right? Because you're starting with your understanding of the whole. You're starting with the philosophy, and then you're burrowing down into the science or the religion of the paragraph. That's the mode you want to get in. Start with the truth, then go to the facts. So you start with the facts, you'll never get to the truth. All you'll get is an ad hoc rationalization scheme for that sentence or that paragraph.
You'll build the facts and you're in.
And it will appear to be true, but it won't really be true. And that's, you know, and you can finally determine that when you try to go beyond the immediacy of that rationalization scheme and discover, oh, well, it doesn't work there. Well, you know, maybe if I just tack on another ad hoc addition, you know, for over there, you know, and the next thing you know, you've got this you know, monstrosity, you know, of rationalization schemes glued together, right? With no truth at all.
I just made a black hole.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we'll pick up there next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.